Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Derek Ellerman. He's the executive director of the Polaris Project in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Derek.
Thank you.
Derek, you have a very interesting story about the founding of the Polaris Project, so I just want to start there. You graduated from Brown University, and that was just a couple years ago.
It was in 2002.
And so how did you get interested in the topic of human trafficking and slavery, and how did that lead to the founding of the Polaris Project?
I actually co-founded it with someone else, Catherine Sean, who's the co-executive director. We were in our last year at Brown, and I had been running another nonprofit dealing with police brutality issues in Providence at the time. And we became aware of an article in the paper that described a case that happened in Providence of six Korean women who had been trafficked into a brothel, to a massage parlor brothel in Providence, Rhode Island, and they had been told they were going to be waitresses. But once they got there, they were forced into prostitution. There were signs of torture, cigarette burns. It was a terrible situation. And it was all printed in the paper. What happened is basically they were arrested and deported, and their trafficker got, I believe, a fine for some sort of health violation. And we were absolutely shocked, I think. One, like many people, we thought that to the degree that we even knew about the problem of human trafficking and modern-day slavery, we thought of it as something that happened maybe in India or in Thailand or in Nepal, but didn't think of it here in the United States. And so it really hit us that it was so close to home. And also, Catherine herself is Korean, and I think it affected her very strongly. And so when we realized that the problem was right, literally here in our backyards, and we did some more research on the state of the movement, which was very young and still is very young, and we realized there was a real need for a more grassroots agency to exist and to do both direct services and to work at the policy level. We decided to start up Polaris Project, and that was about 3.5 years ago.
So you moved to Washington, D.C., and you started to talk to who?
Well, we basically, right after we graduated, the day after, we packed up our stuff, came down to D.C., set up a little office in our living room at the time. And it's grown a lot since then. We now have an office here in D.C., an office in Tokyo, and just opened one this summer in New Jersey. And we began really very grassroots. You know, we recruited volunteers. We set up a website called humantrafficking.com, which is a huge research site with a large database of thousands of articles on trafficking. And then we started doing work in the local area. We knew that Washington, D.C. had a problem and was one of the hubs for trafficking in the United States on the East Coast, along with New York as the main central hub, and then Atlanta and Philadelphia and other areas. And so we began doing outreach, and we began talking to women first in the Korean networks and the massage parlors and the spas, which are commercial front brothels. And it was a population where no one had really ever worked with them before in this area. And so it was really a remarkable experience for the first time for many of them to, you know, talk to people who cared about what their situation was, who could speak Korean. We set up a Korean hotline, and we began getting the stories of what was actually happening, and then eventually cases. And within the first year, we had a case of two women who were older who had been threatened with possibly being harmed or even being killed, and felt too scared to leave the brothel. And after they got out, we were able to work with them. And under the new federal law in the year 2000, there was a trafficking law that was passed that created visas for victims of trafficking. They were able to get federal support and obtain visas.
I don't understand. What was the problem with their visa not having visas?
Well, they originally were smuggled in. And then they were brought to a brothel location in the D.C. area. And when they realized that it was going to be commercial sex that they were going to have to do, they wanted to leave. But the brothel keeper, through various threats, had them, you know, basically too scared to leave. And not speaking the language and not knowing where else to go, it was very difficult for them to get out of the situation. So after they were able to get out with law enforcement intervention, we were able to work with them to provide services and housing and translation and legal services. And they and their family were able to get visas. And actually one of them was just reunited with her family for the first time in 6 years, which is wonderful. So that was one of our early cases. And since that time, we have expanded our work. We've done work in the Korean networks, in the Latino networks. We've done a lot of work recently with what's called domestic or internal trafficking. A lot of people, you know, think trafficking is really some sort of forced migration or forced smuggling, whereas both under federal law as well as under international standards, trafficking is more accurately defined as modern-day slavery. It's a situation where people are either forced into work or forced into some sort of commercial sexual exploitation. And that applies also to people who are within a country. So most people who are trafficked, for instance, in India, are Indians. And it's very similar here in the U.S. Many of the women and almost all the children in the sex industry here in the United States, under federal law, are considered victims of trafficking, because either they're being forced through pimps, they've been threatened, or if they're children, then automatically they're considered victims of trafficking because they can't consent being children. So we've been doing a lot of work in the D.C. area lately, working with both children and adults who have been forced into prostitution, some of them at the age of 12, 13, 14 years old, who are now, you know, 18, 19, 20, and have just led horrific lives. And really, there's been no support for them at all. And also recently, we've been doing more labor trafficking cases in the D.C. area. So the work has very much expanded in the last 3 years. And we've also been able to begin to do a lot of policy work and a lot of grassroots work nationally to raise awareness, to build chapters in California and Colorado and Boston and different areas, and to work a lot on particularly passing state legislation, which is incredibly important right now.
You raised the issue of consent and the coercion. Mm-hmm. Have you looked at the Dutch and Arizonan experience? And what is the position of Polaris or you yourself personally of whether some kind of regulated legalization of sex work would overcome the covert and hidden and coercive nature of the kind of practices that you're trying to stamp out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Nevada and Netherlands and Germany and New Zealand.
It's Nevada, isn't it? It's not Arizona.
Yep. No problem. Have some sort of legalization scheme. And then a lot of countries are also default sort of legalized. There's just so little regulation where there's no enforcement, really, that in effect it's legalized. I think there are a lot of arguments for legalization and for regulation. And some of the arguments that have been put forth include, you know, that if it is regulated, that it will help bring the industry sort of out of the underground. And also other arguments that, you know, it hasn't gone away all this time. It's the world's oldest profession, and therefore, you know, it's sort of unrealistic to think that it's going to go away. I think in practice, though, there are various intellectual arguments. The reality for people working on the ground and seeing the actual problems of implementation of these policies in places like the Netherlands and Germany, other areas, is that the trafficking has actually increased, not decreased. And there's a lot of reasons why, and a lot of them are just sort of unforeseen, you know, policy implementation issues. One of the major ones of which is that no country in the world right now has either the resources or the political will to meaningfully regulate the sex industry. You go to a place like Netherlands, which is, you know, very rich, very well off. They get a lot of tax money from the sex industry. There are thousands of different commercial sex operations. And there are a handful of police to regulate them. Therefore, the idea that you can meaningfully regulate, you know, to protect the women and children that are in the sex industry just is not realistic right now. And that's particularly true in a place like, you know, say Thailand or India. So what has happened is that the legalization has led to a rise in demand. And with the rise in demand, of course, there's more incentives for the different networks to bring people in as supply. And most of those criminal networks have no particular motivation to be regulated. You know, if you can bring in a woman or a child and get more money for it and pay them less or pay them not at all, and there's very little risk of you being enforced against, why would you do it? And so the argument that, you know, creating a regulated situation would sort of bring the industry up from the underground has not happened. It's been the opposite. The underground has actually grown even larger because most of the sex industry, you know, opts out of any sort of regulation scheme.
So your perception is that, or perhaps you even have numbers, is that the Dutch don't have a smaller problem with illegal and coercive sex trade. They actually have a bigger problem than other countries?
Well, it's hard to compare country to country, but I think it's safe to say that it hasn't worked. You know, what was expected in terms of the decrease in trafficking has not happened, and if anything, there's been an increase. Just one example, for instance, there's a major area where there's been a lot of street prostitution, and they regulated the area, they legalized it, they set up booths and so on, and they ran it for about a year and a half, and they had to shut the whole thing down because it was absolutely overrun with organized crime. Most of them were trafficked, there were children there. And again, this is in the Netherlands that has, you know, very advanced criminal justice system, has a lot of money, and if it can't work there, it's, you know, even less likely to work elsewhere. And then you look at other countries that have taken a different tact. For instance, I think the most progressive policy in the world right now is in Sweden. In Sweden, there's a very feminist government. A lot of the people in the national legislature are women, and so they're progressive in many different ways. And I think their prostitution policy is certainly a reflection of that. They have criminalized those who are on the control side, those who run the operations. And they criminalize those who buy commercial sex, but they've decriminalized people who are prostituted. And so the enforcement has been focused on the johns and on the brothel keepers and the pimps, and there's been a substantial decrease in trafficking and in the overall size of the sex industry during that time in the last few years. And it's really one of the only countries in the world that can point to that. So I think there's strong arguments for certain types of decriminalization, particularly for those who are prostituted, but I think the policy experience has shown that legalizing for those who control the industry and for those who buy commercial sex is not a good idea and leads to more trafficking and to more abuse.
I'm speaking with Derek Ellerman. He's the co-executive director of the Polaris Project, which works on the problem of international human trafficking and sex slavery. I assume you saw that yesterday there was a big bust in England of 19 women who were liberated from a compound where they were being coercively kept for sex slavery, and they came from Greece, Turkey, Poland, Latvia, Italy, Japan, and Hong Kong. So that really illustrates the international dimension of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, trafficking right now is the third largest criminal industry in the world after drugs and arms, which is amazing to think about. The modern-day slavery today is the third largest, and it's the fastest-growing criminal industry in the world. The reason why is because if you look at all the various criminal industries out there, the fundamental things that drive the market dynamics of these industries is that they need to be extremely high profit and they need to be low risk. And trafficking has that equation, unlike most other, to a degree, I think unlike most other criminal industries. There is not a country in the world right now where you have a serious risk of being arrested and convicted for trafficking. That's including here in the United States, and there's a huge focus on it here in the U.S. Relatively speaking, it's a crime for which there is almost complete impunity, and as long as that equation remains the same, the market dynamics just really are driving this industry in a way that's just scary.
I'm forgetting the name of the journalist and the publication, but there was I think in the New York Times or the New York Magazine, someplace last year, an article about a journalist who had done a series of underground investigations of the trafficking of children around the country. And he argued that there were tens of thousands of children being held in sex slavery in various suburban homes around the country. other people thought that his numbers and his investigative method were out of whack with reality, and that we would know more about, we would see more of this, these places being busted here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is a tendency sometimes to overstate the case, or is the general tendency just to completely ignore and understate the case of the extent of sexual trafficking, especially of children, which is so horrible?
I mean, I think there can be a risk, of course, for overstatement. I don't think we're at that place yet, though. You look at the United States right now, I think most people recognize that at this point, or many people recognize who are aware of trafficking, that there are women from Latin America, there are women from Korea, from China, from other areas that are trafficked in the commercial sex networks in the United States under horrific conditions very often. But it's interesting that with all this, with the attention focused on many of the foreign nationals, there hasn't been as much attention on the U.S. citizens, which is very interesting because for anyone who works on the ground with actual cases, on the domestic side, most women, for instance, who are on the street were originally trafficked when they were quite young. The average age of first being prostituted in the United States is 13 years old. It's extremely young. And the reason why is that the sort of dominant recruiting mechanism that's used by street pimps and those who run escort agencies and so on, certain types of escort agencies, is recruiting from the runaway population in the United States. There have been a number of major federal studies that have been done looking at the rates of commercial sexual exploitation of American children. And children who run away or who are in foster care or who are in group homes are incredibly at risk. And many of them are sex trafficked by, in many cases, street pimps. And these cases are horrific. I mean, literally, just to give you some examples of the cases that we've been dealing with just in the past couple of months, we've had a number of clients who were either kidnapped or bought or recruited when they were 12, 13 years old originally. And literally, their entire childhood, they should have been in school, they should have been having friends, they should have been going to the prom. They've had to spend out on the street every single night having sex with strangers, at risk for being raped, for being killed, stabbed, beaten, getting STDs. They've had to make anywhere from $500 to $1,000 every single night to give to their pimp, none of which they keep. They're moved around from city to city. It's a horrific existence. And most of the people who, as we're driving around, going through downtown or something, we see someone on the street. In most cases, that's the background of that person. And people don't realize that. People don't think of it as trafficking, even though under federal law, it is, of course. So that's slowly beginning to change now. You're beginning to have more awareness. There's new federal legislation that's been focused on addressing this problem. And increasingly, we're also having federal prosecutions under the trafficking statutes. Here in D.C., with the task force that we helped develop with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Metropolitan Police here, we've had a number of pimps who were trafficking 13-year-olds, 17-year-olds, who have been convicted under trafficking statutes. So I think the place we're at right now, I think Americans need to understand the scope and severity. We're not at the stage yet where I think to any degree it's overblown.
You mentioned the fact that, with the legalization that's occurred in Holland and other places, that countries haven't given the sufficient police attention to the regulation of the industry so that the coercive aspects and the trafficking of children is stamped out. And that raises the question, how many resources would we have to put at this problem to actually stamp this out more effectively worldwide? I see that there's a UN global program against the trafficking in human beings. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm a huge supporter of the increasing the power of transnational institutions, transnational policing for this and other reasons. But it seems that, as you noted, this being, a fairly difficult thing to identify and actually stamp out has been our experience with this over the years. So, what are some of the policies that you think are the points of leverage where we actually could put more resources in and have more of an effect?
I mean, the first thing is to understand this is a criminal industry, and it is driven by market forces. People often talk about sort of the root causes of trafficking in modern-day slavery as being poverty and inequality. And while those are certainly factors, from a strategic point of view, trafficking exists in both wealthy countries as well as poor countries. And in terms of where resources are going to be put, I think the weakest link is very much the direct forces that drive the profit and that decrease risk for the traffickers. That's the weakest link to be focused on. So I think probably the most efficient policies that can be put in place in countries that do have a robust criminal justice system are to focus very strongly on enforcement against the traffickers and also enforcement against the demand side. And this isn't just with sex trafficking. This is also with labor trafficking. We've been talking a lot about the sex side, but a vast percentage of the trafficking in the world is labor-based. It's happening in factories. It's happening on farms. It's happening in sweatshops that are contracted by multinational corporations. And, it's important, of course, to provide all the direct services. It's important to try and raise awareness among vulnerable populations who may be trafficked. But there has to be very strong focus on enforcement against the demand side and on the trafficker side. And that's what will change the equation, ultimately, of high profits, low risk. And introducing profit obstacles, such as having asset forfeiture, where the government, takes the assets of the traffickers, much like has happened in, drug enforcement, and hopefully can also use those assets to bolster their resources against trafficking.
One of the things that occurred during the first Gulf War was an increased attention, at least on the part of American progressives, to the failures of the Saudi state. And it seemed particularly ironic that we were going over to defend Saudi Arabia from the predations of Iraq when Saudi Arabia was practicing, in particular, human trafficking, in the sense that they were bringing in lots of laborers from South Asia and keeping their visas and coercing them into labor. Are there particular states on your 10 worst list that are states that practice coercive labor and human trafficking that we should be focusing on? Or is this just such a pandemic problem that it's pointless to make such a list?
I mean, I think the reality is that it really is a pandemic problem. There is not a country in the world you can point to that doesn't have a problem with trafficking. And, most countries really don't make any serious effort to stem the tide. There are a few countries that may make high-profile efforts, but when you look at what that actually means on the ground, it very often doesn't amount to much, and that includes to some degree here in the United States. The U.S. government releases a report every year called the Trafficking Persons Report out of the State Department, where it literally ranks many of the countries according to whether or not they meet minimum standards against trafficking. And it's a remarkable diplomatic tool in the sense that there's literally an entire office in the State Department devoted to this one human rights issue, which is somewhat unheard of. And they are the goal of this report is really to pressure different governments to up their standards and up their enforcement and strengthen their legislation. And it's worked in some cases. You look at a situation like Japan, which has one of the worst trafficking situations in the world, and particularly on the sex side, has done nothing, really. There is no federal law, there's no enforcement, there's no victim services, there's no money at all. And after the report came out and ranked Japan very low on the tiers, Japan really just reversed itself almost immediately and it passed a national law. It started putting money into victim services. It changed their immigration policy to some degree. And so you've seen some success with the singling out strategy. But you've also seen some, corruption of the process. There's a penalty for the worst offenders where they're in this Tier 3, and there's this threat of sanctions that will be leveled against them. And we used to joke before the first sanctions were to start that the only countries left would be North Korea, Cuba, Libya, and so on, Burma. And unfortunately, that's what happened. All the countries that were in Tier 3 that weren't sort of already entirely sanctioned, diplomatically cut off, were taken out. Some countries that are allies were moved up. Some countries that are not allies, such as Venezuela, were unfairly targeted. So, I mean, there's been some corruption in this process, but by and large, I think it's been tremendously useful in raising international awareness and getting some government commitments.
One final question following on that one, which is about the politics of this in Washington. Mm-hmm. The Clinton administration, I know, gave a certain amount of attention to this issue. This issue has also been close to the heart of the Christian, certain Christian activists who have looked at, you know, the situation in some African countries and attempted to mobilize some support. So I bet that there's some odd alliances possible there in Washington between people on the Christian right and feminists on the left trying to mobilize around these issues.
Mm, oh, definitely. It's absolutely, especially around this issue. We ourselves, we're a very progressive left feminist agency, but we have worked in coalition occasionally with those on the right that we disagree with pretty much every other position they have, except that they do care about this issue. So it's a strange situation, certainly, but it's nice to work on an issue, having worked on police brutality before, that is a little more bipartisan, or a lot more bipartisan. It's something that even though it's a human rights issue, it is close to the hearts of a lot of conservatives. And I think there's also a payoff. I think there are so few human rights issues that conservatives care about that this is one of them. And so there is more of a political payoff in some way for conservatives to champion this issue than, say, a leftist, where this is just one of many, you know, different human rights issues.
Okay, so tell us how people can get involved. There's the website, polarisproject.org, that folks can go to and read about this issue and your involvement in it. What else can they do?
Yeah, we are very strong advocates of people getting involved. We're founded very much in the spirit of sort of a modern-day underground railroad, bringing survivors, bringing regular community members, bringing professionals together. We have a number of grassroots campaigns that we run. One of the main ones that we're launching now is called the National Freedom Run, which is basically an opportunity for folks in their local area to do runs and walks to help raise awareness and help raise funds for the anti-trafficking movement. And you can check that out at nationalfreedomrun.org. And if you go to polarisproject.org, you can also sign up as a member, sign up to volunteer, and we have chapters in different parts of the country that you can also get involved in. So I strongly urge people to learn more, and there is a need. There's a very strong need for folks on the ground to get involved. So definitely feel free to visit polarisproject.org.
Derek, you're such an inspiring story, and I hope that everyone pays attention to what can be done with a good idea and some serious dedication. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jay, for inviting me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.